Mike Hirsch, you guys ready to rock and roll here? Okay, hey everybody, this is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman back for another session, the 48th session of the Green Power and Green Grassroots Emergency Election Protection Coalition. I want to note that today is April 26th. Tomorrow is April 27th, which is 1 year since we started these calls. This is actually our anniversary call. We still have the great Mike Hirsch. And hey, Ruth. Ruth Strauss, how are you? We have the great Mike Hirsch and Steve Caruso co-engineering. We've got my co-convener, Joel Siegel. And we have a tremendous agenda today to cover. I do want to start by mentioning that today is Chernobyl Day. It's the 35th anniversary of that horrendous event. And I have to tell you, I'm going to recommend, I don't know how many of you seen the 5-part HBO series on Chernobyl, but it is, I'm going to say this, this sounds like a real, you know, out there statement, but of all the things that I have ever seen on television or in a movie theater, this is the most devastating. It is a 5-part series made by HBO on the Chernobyl disaster. It is a docudrama. In other words, it's not a documentary, but it is a dramatic presentation based on what actually happened at Chernobyl. It is absolutely horrifying. It is about 90% true. They took a few liberties. For example, they have Emily Watson playing a whistleblower scientist. Now, she in real life was actually a compendium of many scientists in Russia, in Ukraine and the USSR who were warning about what was going on. So she is semi-fictional. But this a 5-part series is the most devastating thing I've ever seen, knowing the nuclear issue and knowing about what happened at Chernobyl. They did an incredible job. And my recommendation, if we can post the link in the chat, it's from HBO, it's just called Chernobyl. It's 5 parts, it runs, I think, 7 or 8 hours. And I recommend that if you're gonna see it, what you should do, and I didn't do this and I regret it, you should take a day, start watching it in the morning and watch it all the way through. Because if you watch it in pieces, you carry this stuff over the next few days. And I couldn't sleep. I am rarely affected by things I see on TV or in the movie theater, but this is incredibly powerful. And you know, the Chernobyl accident killed over 1 million people. And it was entirely avoidable. And so if you watch this series, you will understand why we are trying to shut the nuclear power industry. I've been working on the nuclear power issue since 1973, before most of you were born. And nothing in my experience has made me change in any way, shape, or form my opposition to nuclear power, except to make it stronger. And Howie and I have been working on this issue God knows how long. Howie's, of course, much younger than I am. But you know, the fact is that to really understand nuclear power and what we're up against, you have to see this series. So I'll just leave it at that. HBO, Chernobyl, and you may have to pay for it if you don't have HBO, I don't know, but it's worth it. And watch it through the entire day, because it is absolutely devastating and virtually entirely accurate, which is just terrifying. So I'll leave it at that. I did go, by the way, to Kiev in 96, the 10th anniversary of the accident, and all our worst fears were confirmed. And I want to commemorate one of my best friends and one of the great anti-nuclear activists, a guy named Michael Marriott, who I miss terribly, he was a wonderful guy. He was at the conference and he went to Chernobyl after the conference because he wanted to see it. And I begged him not to go there. And if you ever get the chance to go to Chernobyl, do not go there. Don't go anywhere near that place. And don't go near Fukushima either. So, you know, I'm putting out a piece tomorrow at Reader's Supported News. We advocate that the Tokyo Olympics be canceled because there are radioactive hotspots all over Japan because of Fukushima. And who knows what the next accident will be. I will commemorate within the next couple of days, thank God, and thank the anti-nuclear movement, the Indian Point reactor, number 3, the last one, will shut outside of New York City. So thankfully for that, and for that, we actually have Andrew Cuomo to thank. He unfortunately is bailing out 4 other reactors in New York. That's another story that Howie knows very well. But nonetheless, don't go near Chernobyl. I will never go back to Japan. I've been in Japan twice. I actually marched against Fukushima in 1978 in Japan, and I will not go back. And so our job here, our principal job in America is to shut the 93 reactors that they still have operating. And it's a race against time because these reactors average 40 years old, and God knows when the next one's gonna blow up, and God help us when it does. So I'll leave it at that. And it's one of the things, but I will say that since we are an election protection operation here, there has never been a public referendum on whether or not they're gonna build a nuclear plant. They just go ahead and build them. And you know, when we try and shut them down, they stop our referendum. In fact, a year ago in Ohio, we put together a referendum to stop a bailout for the 2 nuclear reactors in Ohio on Lake Erie. And this is unfortunately a sign of the times for our issue. People who were circulating petitions to repeal the nuclear bailout in Ohio were physically assaulted by people paid by the nuclear industry. And you know, if that's the future of American elections, God help us again. So there you go. I realize this is not officially an anti-nuclear call, but this is the anniversary, and we need to be aware. Okay, so passing on that, we're gonna start today. We have the great Andrea Miller with us, and she's gonna join us in a while to talk about democracy centers. We had a long talk about them last week, and we're gonna be pushing a forward with them this week. Jeffrey, I see your hand, but we'll get to you in a few minutes, okay? I wanna start in with this. Joel Siegel, are you on the call? Joel, you with us? My co-convener. We are gonna start with the discussion of DC statehood, and then and Puerto Rico statehood. I wanna mention as a sort of a historical overview, and this hasn't been discussed a whole lot in this process of getting DC statehood, but the tradition, and it is a serious tradition in American history, is to bring in states in pairs. And in other words, there are instances where single states have joined the Union. But in 1820, to take us back, Missouri wanted to come into the United States as a state, as a slave state. And the free states did not want to do that. And so what they did was they separated what's now Maine from Massachusetts. And historically, Maine had been part of Massachusetts. In 1820, they separated Maine from Massachusetts and they brought in Missouri and Maine together so that it kept the balance of free states and slave states. And from 1820 to 1850, there were 5 more pairs of states that were brought in. And in fact, they kept Texas out of the Union because Texas had won its independence from Mexico in 1836, but they couldn't find a free state to bring it in with until 1845, 9 years. So, and then of course, the last pair of states that were brought in were Alaska and Hawaii. And instead of slave and free, we're talking now about balancing between Democrat and Republican. So the idea that maybe it would help bringing in DC if it was balanced by Puerto Rico is something that people are talking about. So I want to go, James Fukuda, if we can start with you, if you could talk about the situation in Puerto Rico, and we'll balance you with Charles Moreland from DC and go back and forth on that. I think it'd be an interesting discussion, please.
Harvey?
Yes, Joel, there you are. Okay.
So make sure, make sure you know I was here.
Yeah, I didn't see you there. I was looking for you. So, Joel, I'm going to turn this over to you. We can start with James and Charles and do whatever you want, please. This is Joel, Dr. Funkenstein, Siegel, my co-conspirator on these calls. So thank you, Joel.
I don't know who put Dr. Funkenstein, but I consider that an honor since I am a professional funk bass player.
Okay, go for it.
All right. So let's start with, go ahead and start with Brother Charles, and then we're going to go into Puerto Rico state. And we got two different speakers.
Okay, so Charles and James, that's fine. Is that all right with you, James? Okay, thank you, James.
All right.
Okay, Charles, and then James. And by the way, the rest of the call, after this, we're going to talk about Democracy Centers with the great Andrew Miller. And then we're going to go in at the very end of the call at 6:15 Eastern Time. We have Ray Lutz in Arizona. And we have really deep inside information on this insane recount of a mere 2.1 million votes that they want to do in Arizona. So that'll be at 6:15 Eastern Time. And we'll talk to Ray Lutz about that. He's in Phoenix right now. So let's go ahead, James and Charles, however you want to do it. Joel, it's your show.
Yeah, and then we got a really special guest, Ricardo Mercado from Corazon Latino, who is really knows so much about Puerto Rico. Ricardo, do we got you? Brother Ricardo, mi hermano.
We got Ricardo. Well, maybe he'll join us by the time Charles and
he's on. I talked to him. He's Ricardo, okay, got you?
Can you guys hear me now? I think I might be muted.
No, you're not. You're good.
Thank you now.
Okay, there we go.
Good to hear your voice, Ricardo. Okay. So, Joel, Charles.
This is Charles.
Brother Charles.
I am so interested in seeing and hearing why anybody would think or would want to pair the District of Columbia with Puerto Rico for statehood that I would suggest that we hear that that first. And I'd like to respond to that.
Okay.
All right, we got the great James Fukuda with us. James?
Yeah, let me, for those of you who, I mean, you've seen James and heard James, but James is works on the ground in Puerto Rico with, you know, affordable housing for the homeless and the most vulnerable populations of seniors. That's where I met James. I met James in Puerto Rico, but James works closely with, you know, elected officials, the governor there. And I saw him in action, and I just felt like he has his ear to the ground. And then Ricardo, of course, knows so much too. So James, why don't you start? The question would be, just based on your knowledge about Puerto Rico, where is the statehood movement in Puerto Rico? I know you have the Independista movement down there, but what's your take on, I know the governor actually ran on statehood, but what's your take on the movement in Puerto Rico? How much following does it have? And do you see anything happening in Congress on Puerto Rico statehood? Thanks, James.
Well, with acknowledging that that we have the doctor on the line with us, I will give you the Blanquito version of how things work in Puerto Rico. So the traditional notion of Democrat and Republican does not work at all on the island, right? They have their own political parties. They have the PNP, which is the New Progressive Party. And that is the party that the current resident commissioner, delegate to observe the Senate belongs to. That is a woman named Jennifer Gonzalez Colon, who looks like a white lady until she opens her mouth, and then she has the very thick accent, so you realize, oops, she's not. She caucuses with the Republicans. Right. So the one of the interesting things about Puerto Rico politics, when Puerto Ricans come to the U.S., they become Democrats. But when they're in Puerto Rico, they belong to the PNP, the PDP, or the PR Independencias, which do align but don't align with Democrats and Republicans. So the three main parties in Puerto Rico have three different different stances towards statehood. They have election after election, the majority of people do favor statehood, but you still have more than 45% either favor independence or commonwealth. So what they mean by commonwealth is we want to maintain the advantages of being affiliated with the United States, but we don't want to be a state because we're afraid that we'll lose our unique cultural identity and end up like Hawaii. Then the independentes say we should just be an independent country, and the pro-statehood people say the only way that Puerto Rico can advance is having the full rights of being a state. So although the Republicans are afraid of statehood because they think that they're creating, 4 million more Democratic votes with senators and however many Congress people that represents, I think that's seven or something like that. That's probably true, but not entirely true, because the resident commissioner right now caucuses with the Republicans. So it's not as clear cut for the Democratic Party as DC statehood is. And this is still very, very, very hotly contested in Puerto Rico. And I'm sure the doctor can fill you in a lot more about that. What I have learned to say is that the people in Puerto Rico on the island need to settle this among themselves, because they are very insulted even when Puerto Ricans who now live in New York express any strong opinions about it.
Okay, thank you, James.
Thank you, James.
I wanted to add one other thing that Dorothy mentioned, Joel, just before you weren't on yet. Ted Lieu's solarification bill. Joel and I wrote that and got Ted Lieu's office to introduce it.
Well, Dorothy is very close to Ted,
it was my idea. I told Joel to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, also
we've closed the loop then.
Yes. Well,
so I was just texting Joel if we should try to do a working group or something and try to, once it gets through, to try to facilitate its implementation.
Well, we weren't moving anywhere, and then Dorothy made one call to the chief of staff, and then somehow I flew over to LA, and Dorothy had a big party, and Representative Ted Lieu was there. That's where I met Harvey. I stayed with Harvey. So Dorothy, without you, none of this would have happened. And James, without you, it really wouldn't have happened.
Well, I have to tell you that the day that the hurricane happened, I emailed Harvey, and he can verify this, and said, we need to solarize Puerto Rico because it's a perfect test case. And I had already told Mark about this. I had already put this all in motion. So if you came with the actual bill so he didn't have to write it, that's great. But it was already going to happen one way or another.
Well, let's hope Solartopia comes to Puerto Rico real soon. And let's see, do they want statehood or not, Joel?
Yeah, sure. Ricardo, hola. Good to haven't talked to you in a while. I'd like to hear your perspective as someone who's, I remember that I thought you were from Puerto Rico, but can you tell us about the statehood movement, and what's your perspective on it? Is Ricardo on mute?
He's on mute.
Ricardo?
And thank you, James.
Yes, there we go. Is it working now?
Yeah. Yeah, we can hear you, Ricardo.
Okay.
Okay, wonderful.
Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the space. Well, good evening. First, I wanted to begin by addressing the dichotomy. The discussion today is about statehood and the topics of the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. However, these are two very different situations. I'm of the opinion that the situation in the District of Columbia should be characterized as a civil rights situation. However, the situation with respect to Puerto Rico's colonial relationship to the United States is one of international human rights. The independence movement and the statehood movement have one major difference, and that is that the United States government and the FBI have never assassinated a pro-statehood activist, while on the other hand, the pro-independence movement has been the target of many crippling attacks by the U.S. government, and I'm sure all of you are familiar with COINTELPRO, which was deployed to destroy the Black Panther organization and other groups like it in the United States. So before COINTELPRO came to fruition in the United States, a lot of those tactics of surveillance and infiltration and destabilization were practiced in Puerto Rico in the 1950s, the 60s, and the 70s. It was mentioned earlier, the composition of support of the different status options in Puerto Rico. Because of this historic persecution, a lot of the people who do support independence very rarely express it publicly for fear of reprisal. And a lot of people who would be willing to support it end up in the camp of the so-called Commonwealth, which is just a colonial device the United States deployed while it faced pressure in the 20th century, push for decolonization around the world. And a lot of the levers of power and a lot of the economic centers of power in Puerto Rico are controlled by these people. So it's very difficult for young people to get away from that. I also did want to touch on the fact that there's a lot of conversation around the makeup of Puerto Rican electoral politics if it did become a state. And I can guarantee all of you that Puerto Rico would not be a democratic state. Puerto Rico is an extremely, extremely conservative society. And I think everybody would be surprised with the outcome of an election for representatives and senators in Puerto Rico. And it would not be a guarantee that the Democratic Party would have a stronghold there. And so I can maybe go into different aspects of the history, or I could go into different aspects of the current climate. I'm not sure if anybody has any specific questions, but I think those are some of the important points that I wanted to clear up. And I also wanted to make a point of addressing a lot of the coverage that Puerto Rico has received and a lot of the opinion columns that you'll read in spaces like the Washington Post or the New York Times. A lot of these very high profile publications, it's always important to recognize which voices are the ones that are able to bubble up to the top. And for the most part, the people that are get granted access to these spaces are people who do not reflect the socioeconomic background of the majority of people in Puerto Rico. And these people more often than not belong to particular interest groups, and they have hidden agendas pushing one or the other proposal. So it's very rare that a working class person or someone who supports independence has the opportunity to make their case in these forums. And I think that has had a negative impact on the way that people in the United States have been discussing this issue in the last few years. And I did appreciate the comment from the person who spoke just before me, because I do think that the issue of Puerto Rico's decolonization is an issue that needs to be resolved by the Puerto Rican people. And in my opinion, that has to include the diaspora as well. And I think that it is something that we have to speak amongst ourselves about. And unfortunately, the process has been stalled, and we have been tripped up along the way, mostly by intervention from the United States government. So I think those things are very important to remember when we're discussing these two issues. It's very difficult for someone like me to hear the discussions that, carry on in the circles of power and influence that conflate these two situations when in fact they are very, very different from each other.
Ricardo, I'm just gonna, so be honest with you, this is the first time that we've had a chance to even listen to people like yourself and James who understand the situation. I'm just gonna ask you two questions, then I'm gonna throw it over to Harvey. If there was a poll taken right now for or against DC statehood, I'm sorry, against Puerto Rico statehood, do you have any idea of what that might look like in terms of support for Puerto Rican statehood?
There have been several plebiscites. The issue with the plebiscites, of course, and the comrade that talked about ranked choice voting would probably be happy for me to mention this, but since there's no ranked choice voting in Puerto Rico, and the way that the questions and the polls have been formulated has caused a lot of issues with understanding public opinion. And of course, the new Progressive Party will formulate the question, statehood, yes or no. The Commonwealth Party would formulate the question, Commonwealth, yes or no. And so that, I think, has caused a lot of issue. And it's also important to recognize that a lot of the polls that have been taking place in Puerto Rico are non-binding referendums. The U.S. Congress has a supreme authority over Puerto Rico, and the character of the polls being non-binding has reduced turnout and has reduced people's willingness to participate and trust in those institutions. But if there was a snap election today, statehood would not win. And like I mentioned before, in my personal opinion, the question of Puerto Rico's status is incomplete without hearing the voices of the diaspora. And so as an aside, one of the, there's currently two pieces of legislation battling it out in the U.S. Congress with respect to Puerto Rico's status. And I think that neither Nidia Velazquez's project nor the pro-statehood project, they fail to recognize the importance of the diaspora. And it's a political problem for the United States, because to allow for the diaspora to vote would require the United States government to recognize that Puerto Ricans have a separate quality of nationality. And it's been a very hard-fought process for the United States to recognize, after the imposition of U.S. citizenship in the 1920s, that Puerto Ricans would have another legal mechanism of representation. So it's not like the United States' treatment of the Venezuelan diaspora, for example, which the United States takes advantage of their anti-Maduro and Chavez sentiments to support their voting from the exterior, but they have not extended the same privilege to the Puerto Rican diaspora in any of the processes. So I think that's also something that needs to be put into context.
Thank you. And then the second question is, I saw the governor of Puerto Rico on 60 Minutes, who he ran on statehood, he got elected. James and I had a very good meeting with the former governor who the people pushed out. And but when I was talking to people, I did a documentary on the hurricanes, went up to the mountains and talked to different people just to do a documentary on how horrible those hurricanes were. But one thing I heard time and time again from people, at least in the mountains, they were saying, many of them said they were pro-statehood, because they wanted Medicaid and a higher reimbursement rate. They wanted money for housing, which, you know, if you become a state, then there, of course, there'd be more, you know, appropriations from Congress to Puerto Rico. A lot of people that I met in Puerto Rico go back and forth to the states, to Puerto Rico, because of the economy. So that was his perspective, and many people in the very poor rural areas. Is that something that you've heard as well? I'm not asking you to take any position. I'm just trying to convey what I heard.
Sure. So the New Progressive Party historically has altered their message to receive support from the people. So if you listen closely to the discussions that are being had by someone like the current governor and someone like the previous governors, they're focusing on the angle of decolonization. So they've adopted the discursive element very recently. In the past, the slogans of the New Progressive Party were that statehood is for the poor. So the problem with the situation today is that there's no equality with respect to the federal programs that are implemented in Puerto Rico. However, the New Progressive Party has billed admission as a state as some kind of magic cure for Puerto Rico's economy, even though we understand that there are plenty of states in the United States who have abysmal employment rates, who have abysmal problems with houselessness, the District of Columbia being one where houselessness is endemic. And it's unclear that statehood would solve the problem of houselessness there because it has not solved it in San Francisco. That is the rhetoric that is adopted. And it's also important to look at the election results and understand that the current governor was elected with a 23% approval and a participation rate below the standard 70%, 80%. So in reality, over 70% of eligible voters and well over 70% of the population at large does not approve of the current regime.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you so much. James Ficuda, do you have anything to add? Then we're going to switch over to DC.
I'll just say that I agree totally. And I'll remind you, Joel, when we met with Rosselló, I commented to you that he dressed like somebody from Yale. You know, the political class in Puerto Rico has absolutely, positively nothing to do with the average person on the street, and certainly not the campesinos up in the mountains.
Wow. Okay, sounds like the rest of the United States in that respect. Well, this is really fascinating. And thank you both. Lynn, you've got your hand. Could you possibly, Lynn, can you ask your question real quick?
Yeah, here's my question. I didn't hear much about the independence movement and about Puerto Rican separate nationhood. Where do people stand on that and how do you guys feel about it?
Okay, well, real quick. James?
Go ahead.
Or Ricardo, either one of you.
Ricardo, please take the lead. I'll come in after you.
Thank you. So the independence movement has a history all the way back to the first slave revolts. And in reality, the first independentistas were the Taínos who fought against Spanish colonialism. Fast forward today, in the last election, the Puerto Rican Independence Party, who turned 75 years old this year, had a historic turnout. The candidate was very successful in getting people out of their shell and mobilizing towards a change. There's a huge dissatisfaction with our duopoly, the same way that there's dissatisfaction with the duopoly in the United States. And as I mentioned before, the United States government has never intervened or attempted to weaken the colonial collaborationist parties. It has only ever attempted to besmirch the name of the independence movement. And that's evident in education and everything like that. But people are starting to warm up to the idea. The problem is that there are very many different opinions as to what independence might look like. The Independence Party takes a much more reformist parliamentary approach, and they propose dialogue and deliberation with the United States and the transition to independence, which is very idealistic in my personal opinion, especially reflecting upon not only our history, but the history of other independence movements in the Caribbean. For example, in Grenada, Ronald Reagan invaded Grenada and stamped out their independence movement, and the the Navy and the Air Force practiced for Grenada's invasion in Vieques and Culebra in Puerto Rico. I think that as the Independence Party grows, it has an opportunity to reach even 30, even 40% by the time the next elections roll around, because there's also a very large section of the population that supports independence quietly and, like I mentioned before, is not willing to go public. But if there's the development of a popular movement, then those people might feel more safe.
All right.
And I also mentioned that the diaspora, you'll find a larger support per capita of independence.
Okay, James Fukuda?
I don't think that anything is really going to change in our lifetime. You know, because using examples like Grenada, what the Senate and the Congress, what the Defense Department fear is creating another Cuba offshore of the U.S. So anything that isn't firmly in the U.S. camp isn't going to be allowed.
Okay, that's a pretty definitive statement. I want to move to D.C. now. Joel, you all right with that? We good?
Yeah.
Thank you. I want to point out we have 90 people on the call, and that was a really fascinating discussion. I've never heard a discussion like that of Puerto Rico, and I know it's going to come up as D.C. statehood gets more at the center of a possible reality. So I'm really glad we were able to cover that with two really great insiders on that. So thank you, James and Ricardo. Charles Moreland, you have been sitting patiently. Since last we talked, the House of Representatives has voted a second time to approve D.C. statehood. We have a slight problem with the Senate. Can you tell us, and then we'll, what's happening with D.C. statehood now?
Yes. Last Thursday, we took a giant leap towards eliminating taxation without representation in the District of Columbia. The House voted 216 to 208 to pass the DC statehood bill. Let me say something real quick while the thought is still at the top of my mind. I hope, Harvey, that you see why it was so important for James and Ricardo to make their presentation first.
Yeah.
Okay. And I want to thank you, James and Ricardo, for so eloquently and brilliantly driving a stake through the heart of this false equivalency between DC statehood and Puerto Rican statehood. This is a mirage that the members of Congress have floated recently, as they have for years and years, this possibility that the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico should be brought in at the same time as a solution to our problem. They know that that's impossible, impractical. Any proposal to delay our freedom, to delay our struggle, to delay the DC statehood movement until Puerto Rico is ready, is a proposal to keep us disenfranchised. It's an illusion. It's a distraction. And unfortunately, there are some members of Congress who are chasing this ghost. We won't do it. Our request is for statehood now. And we want to make DC statehood a priority. And that ought to be, and we hope that progressive Democrats will not fall for this for a moment. I believe that James and Ricardo have put the discussion of DC statehood combined with Puerto Rican statehood to rest. In fact, I'm going to use, and I wrote down and took notes because they brilliantly explain why we can't be distracted by that. Now, we've been hoodwinked, and we've been had before. In 1978, when the House and the Senate approved the DC Voting Rights Amendment, Jimmy Carter was president. We had solid control of both the House and the Senate. We had all the civil rights leaders, Andy Young, Coretta Scott King, all the civil rights leaders were supporting this Voting Rights Amendment. At the same time, Julius Hobson and the founders of DC statehood were advocating for statehood. But I was part of Walter Fauntroy's staff at the time, right out of law school, having completed a LBJ congressional internship. And we all fell for that. What we thought was the incremental approach of getting two senators and one representative in the House would put us in a better position for statehood. Had we demanded statehood at that time, we'd be a state because we had all the votes. And so we're not going to be distracted again. We were hoodwinked, we were had, and we're not going to have that happen again. DC statehood is the only way we can end taxation without representation in the District of Columbia and make us full first-class citizens. Puerto Rico is different. Puerto Rico doesn't have all the citizens of Puerto Rico doesn't have all the rights. I mean, they don't have the responsibilities and duties that Washingtonians have. We have every duty, every responsibility that all other Americans have. We're drafted, we pay taxes. Puerto Ricans don't have that responsibility. Puerto Ricans have options. There's no way in the world that the District of Columbia can ever become another nation, okay, a sovereign nation. And so statehood is the only solution, is our chosen way. And we want to put that to rest. And I want to thank Harvey, you and Joel, really, for bringing this to the forefront.
Well, listen, we appreciate you. And this has been a really great clarifying discussion. And I really appreciate it. I have been at my local gym. I've actually been watching Fox News. That's like a confessional, I'm sorry. But the arguments they're using against DC statehood are mind-boggling. They're saying that it's a power grab. They're saying that DC residents already have influence because the members of Congress see their yard signs on the way to work, and they're arguing that DC should become a part of Maryland. And that's like the end of it. That's all you hear. And so, you know, you've got a case that can't be beat. Let's just hope that this is a significant step forward with the House of Representatives. And if we can get this through the Senate, it'd be great. Joel?
Yeah, I just want to make sure that next it will be Andrea Miller to talk about the voting centers. Before we get to Andrea, Charles, I just want to ask you a question. First of all, Charles, thank you for your decades of leadership on this issue. But if we're going to get this passed in the Senate, and then you told me yesterday we have to get rid of the filibuster because you can't use budget reconciliation for everything. In fact, the Senate said they can't use budget reconciliation. So what is your message to us? Now, many of us are leaders across the country, you know, on election protection. What is your message about the filibuster? There are those who say, have a talking filibuster. Those who say, oh, let's not get too radical. Personally, I say, get rid of it. We don't need it. We are going to do a major symposium with the epgrassroots.org. What's your feeling about the filibuster?
Joel, as we have discussed before, and I want to make it clear, we're close. But close don't count. Our chances in the Senate, well, there are two chances, slim and skinny, but not impossible. Not impossible. We will never get 60 votes in the Senate unless there is an irresistible demand that has to start with the citizens of Washington, D.C. I am a firm believer that a man can't ride your back unless it's bent. And I do believe that the real power belongs to the people. And so we are organizing right now a campaign in the District of Columbia to start a campaign of civil disobedience. If that's necessary, we will not lay down for this outrageous form of government that is being imposed on us, a system of government that is so ridiculous that if you try to impose it on anybody else in the world, they would take up arms and shoot you dead, like the founding fathers of this nation did. So the filibuster is a dead end, forget it. Right now, we can count on 48 senators. And there are two outliers that it's gonna be very difficult to get, but we have a plan. In fact, we're gonna have a webinar this Thursday. The invitation should be ready for tomorrow. I wanna invite every member of the Progressive Democrats. Where we're going to address all of the opposing arguments. We're going to discuss our strategy, and we're going to be open to other suggestions. We have to do all that we can. When I say we, not just the citizens of Washington, D.C., but progressives and people who love and support democracy all over the country and everywhere in the world, in fact. Because they say it's a power grab, then let it be said that it's a power grab. It's a power grab that the Republicans would make if they had the opportunity to get two more senators. Democrats and Republicans and others spent over $800 million, Joel, as you and Harvey well know, everybody on the phone knows, to get two senators in Georgia that were Democratic senators. We can get two Democratic senators from the District of Columbia. We know they're going to be Democratic because District of Columbia has always and always will vote Democratic. That I can guarantee you. Let them call it a power grab, but I think that's to our benefit because I think we can with two Democratic senators from D.C., we can secure Democratic control of the Senate. And my position on the filibuster is antithetical to democracy. There's no reason whatsoever that anybody should want to have minority control of any legislative body. And that's what that does. It gives the minority control and not majority control.
Charles,
go ahead, Joel.
Yeah, I was gonna say that Progressive Democrats of America has expressed interest in doing a national webinar to explain why DC statehood is something that progressive Democrats need to get behind, and then a series of national call-in days. I mean, if you look at all the people, we have 86 people here. If they called their senator and said, we want you to support, I'm sure it'll be called S51. What do you think we can do to help DC statehood become reality? What can those outside of DC do?
Well, certainly you can do just what you said, Joel. Everybody should write their senators and ask them, those who already support DC statehood, they should be asked to put pressure on their colleagues, on the other senators, the senators that know. And the senators, Republicans, and right now a couple of Democrats who are wishy-washy or considering these other alternatives, let's continue to lobby them and press them. But I always want to point out that I it's hard for me to rely on the Senate to all of a sudden decide they're going to give us our freedom. They're not going to give it to us. We've been here before. I've been working on this movement since 1978. And we have begged and pleaded as in as humble a fashion as any disenfranchised people have ever begged for their freedom. But we're talking about control of the most important piece of real estate on the planet. And as a culture in the Congress, for 220 years, we have been begging in the District of Columbia for an end to taxation without representation. So it's only going to happen when progressive Democrats like yourself and the citizens of Washington, D.C. decide that we will not accept this anymore. Somebody once asked, how much oppression will a man accept? And the answer was, as much as you will accept.
Yeah.
And so the citizens of DC wake up every morning accepting the unacceptable. This is a so-called home rule form of government, reduces us to mere servants at the banquet table of democracy. How do we accept it? I can't accept it. And so this is the message we're trying to communicate to DC residents. And I don't see how progressives anywhere and people who believe in democracy anywhere can accept this. The founding fathers of our nation took up arms against taxation without representation. Yet it exists every day.
Well, one of the people who's been working against it with these democracy centers that we talked about last week, Charles, is Andrea Miller. And we're really glad to have her with us. Andrea? Are you there? You ready to rock and roll?
RB. Yeah.
We're hoping that maybe democracy centers in DC would have an impact. And Joel, I know you and Andrea were going to discuss the issue of democracy centers. Joel, do you want to start interrogating Andrea?
Andrea, I'm gonna ask you what we call in law some leading questions or softball questions, but Charles. Thank you for a phenomenal.
Appreciated, Charles.
Thank you so much. Andrea, we've been talking about democracy centers for a few years. So I'm going to ask you a series of lightning questions. And then, but number one, if you were describing to a 12th grader what's a democracy center, I'm not talking about Donald Trump because he's a first grader, but no, I won't go there. What would you tell a 12th grader? What's a democracy center?
Democracy center is a place where local folks work on very, very local issues. So we're talking about federal issues, and then frequently people talk about state issues. Well, one of the reasons people often don't vote is there's this huge civics disconnect between what is important to them, their kitchen table issues, and the federal government. So in 2017, when we worked in Alabama, a lot of people in Alabama said, look, there is sewage in my backyard. I voted for a Republican. There's sewage in my backyard. I'm going to go vote for your Democrat. If there is still sewage in my backyard, the next time I vote, it will be for whoever gets the sewage out of my backyard. Now, does a U.S. senator have anything to do with the sewage in their backyard? No. It's your member of city council or your county supervisor. But number one, America is pretty desperate for a civics lesson. That's one of the things democracy centers do. They help people identify who is the source of your pain, and then they help them shove back.
Didn't the Black Panthers in the 60s have the equivalent of democracy centers where they had hot lunch programs and hot breakfasts?
Yes. And again, I'm from Maywood, Illinois. I'm from Fred Hampton's hometown. Fred Hampton dated my cousin. Yes.
So this is, okay. So these democracy centers would be located in, and let's say low-income communities where there's...
Yes, because normally, Joel, it is going to be in those low-income communities where people are going through some major economic social justice pain. So they're going to be in rural communities. There's a lot of Black rural communities, and we did a lot of our GOTV turnout work in Black Belt, places like Georgia and North Carolina. Every southern state has a Black Belt, and the Black Belt is, that's where the slave plantations were. Well, when slavery was over, a lot of the slaves didn't leave the area. Their attitude was, look, I know this devil, so I'm going to just stay here with the devil I know. I'm not going somewhere with a new devil where I don't know how that devil works. So that is real American history. So when we establish democracy centers, we don't walk in telling the community, this is what you're going to work on. We work with the community to find out what it is that they need. And they need all kinds of stuff. They live in food deserts. So we help them come up with ways where they can cure that food desert status. And then as we begin identifying this is where the problem is, we bring people into community meetings and they begin to learn about how your elected officials work. And you start to learn how to push back. Then you start to learn more and more and more about these are things that are coming at you from the state level. And these are some good things that are there. So we want this, don't want that. And then we also look at the federal level. And we take all these digital tools and toys that the big organizations in DC have. And we teach folks how to use them for their local stuff, for the state stuff, and the federal stuff.
Oh, okay.
In short, power. We're building that fight back.
Do you have any democracy centers in DC at this point?
No. We have one democracy center in Hawkinsville, Georgia. And we opened it up on December 21st, sort of right in front of the runoff election. They knocked on 2,100 doors. Now, this particular democracy center, they are a food distribution site. They knocked on 2,100 doors and had 1,700 conversations. So democracy centers are trusted organizations or combination of people that are already in the community. So that's what they are. That's why people listen to them. That's why we can say our goal is to turn low propensity voters into voting rights activists because they know where their power is. Our power is our vote. We can put a butt in the seat, and if we don't like what that butt is doing, we can take that butt out and put another butt in.
Again, I'm grateful for all the people that have been with us. We see these two guys clowning away. Thank you, everybody. This will go in the can. We will have it available to you at electionprotection2024.org. Thanks to Steve Caruso and Mike Hirsch, and that'll end our recorded session.